All right, thank you. We are back on the record, and at this time we will proceed with questioning of Laura McCartan by Commissioner Chrisman.
Thank you, Your Honor, and welcome back to North Dakota again, Ms. McCartan.
Thank you, Commissioner.
You've made, I'm kind of just wanting to get something out of print and on the air for anybody who might be listening in. You've made pretty clear here this morning that the purpose of this additional generation is for cost savings for your customers, correct?
Commissioner, yes. We went out with the RFP to see if we could secure low-cost prices. We didn't need to do it at this time to meet our renewable energy standards.
And so the printed statement in here that these are not being proposed to respond to a generating capacity deficiency is correct. There is no deficiency that we're meeting.
That's correct.
Okay. I'm trying to get perspective. There's some discussion in the testimony about 2,200 gigawatts of power per year. I'm trying to get some perspective on that number. If someone came out with an invention now that you found out was next year going to save your customers 2,200 gigawatts per year, would your initial reaction be that you may need a rate increase to meet your fixed costs if you're going to have 2,200 gigawatts less sales?
So your question is, if our customers used this much less energy in a year, what would be the impact be on our sales? On our rates? Geez, I don't know what 22 gigawatt hours, 2,200 gigawatt hours of energy relates to in terms of our total energy use. I do know that when we faced a significant drop in energy use post 2008, there were a lot of our fixed costs that didn't change. Parts of the system that need to be there to meet the system peak, for example, investments that we've made in IT or whatever. And I know that at that time, that was a contributor to a rate request, rate increase request that we faced at that time. But it really depends upon the amount. I just don't know what 2,200 gigawatt hours relates to in terms of percent of our total system use.
Okay. In here somewhere, it's I thought I had these laid out so that I would have it real quickly, but I got it wrong. Anyway, on page 14 of the October 2nd paperwork.
Commissioner, is this Exhibit 1? I've got the exhibits in front of me, so I can be right with you.
From the electronic filing that I had marked up.
Can you identify, Commissioner, maybe what's on page 1?
The public document, trade secret information excised.
It's the October 2nd, 2013 letter, re errata, and it's on Excel letterhead.
To clarify, there was an errata filing made on both petitions, both for the three wind and then the Borders wind separately as well. Do you have a specific page there?
It's page 14, and maybe if I just read this sentence, you know, maybe there's no question of the accuracy, because, I mean, it's just two numbers in here. It says the addition of 600 megawatts of wind power displaces approximately 200 gigawatt hours of electricity production annually at fossil fuel plants. Is there any... does that seem right?
I can't in my brain tell you if that seems right. It would be something I'd like to see So the production of 600 megawatts of these proposed wind projects displaces that much energy use from other sources?
Annually at fossil-fueled plants.
Okay, so that would be, yes, rather than getting that power from those, we still need the power, but it would come from wind rather than those fossil-fueled plants. That was the analysis from our modeling.
Okay, so similar to what happened to you when you faced a sales decline after 2008, would it just be logical to assume then that those producers of the baseload power will have to raise their rates when they have 2,200 gigawatts less sales if this is approved and comes into production?
Commissioner, I don't think that the business model and how our prices are set for a regulated utility are comparable to a power someone who owns a power plant. So I don't really think those – I can't correlate one situation with the other. I don't think they're comparable.
I don't know how we could conclude otherwise that someone can lose a high volume of sales and the plant still exists. I know they would use less fuel, so there would be some savings for them, but it seems to me almost illogical to think that their cost per unit of production would not go up some. And so I guess the bottom line question is, in your calculations of how this is going to save money for your consumers, is anything calculated in for an increased cost of the baseload power that we do know is needed from time to time when the wind isn't blowing? Or do you assume that those costs are going to remain the same as if you didn't add these 750 megawatts of wind?
I think Kurt Hager could walk through exactly how that, I think he could answer your question.
Okay.
I think it really gets into the modeling and the assumptions that we make and how we understand the market works with all of the different power sources that are available.
Okay, I'll save that one for Kurt then. When a company that is within the MISO system adds generation, does MISO require you to pay then for transmission upgrades?
Does MISO require... I believe that when a new power plant comes online and wants to connect to the system, all the implications of when they connect, is there an impact to transmission? Does it require some investment into the transmission? I believe that's all looked at. Exactly how that gets worked out, I think, depends upon the specifics of what that power plant is, its impact on the system. I think generally the cost causer has to pay, but I'm just not really familiar with all the details of how this gets worked out through MISO when a power plant seeks to come in and set up and interconnect to the grid.
Is that in Kurt's wheelhouse too?
I think it could be.
Okay.
Is Kurt nodding? Yes.
There was a discussion about the Prairie Rose project, and has the company under-collected approximately $85,000 of Prairie Rose costs from North Dakota consumers?
I believe that number's correct, given the where we are with that fuel clause recovery issue.
And I really don't understand that. Can you kind of give us an explanation of the history of that? I know that it was built and our commission denied it into the rate base. But so apparently our customers are paying something, but how does it work kind of, and that it comes out that North Dakota consumers saved the $85,000 so far?
Oh, gosh, Commissioner, I didn't come prepared to talk about that, but I think at a high level, it's sort of a paper transaction. We keep track of what our fuel mix is and the costs of that, and we have to sort of do a paper transaction to say if the cost of the Prairie Rose project is not part of the fuel mix that serves the North Dakota customers, then it has to kind of be replaced with something else in terms of calculating it so that you are calculating the cost of the full energy used by North Dakota customers. And so rather than the sliver that would come through that would be the exact Prairie Rose cost, we agreed on some other representative type of cost that is, I believe, reflects sort of the general mix of all of our fuel. Those two numbers are not exactly the same, and so that leads to that gap.
So if the general mix saved North Dakota consumers $85,000, it tells me that the wind energy was more expensive than the general mix. And everything we've been talking about this morning says the opposite, that it's the wind energy that's cheaper and it's going to save all this money, but it sure didn't seem to save on the Prairie Rose project.
Well, the Prairie Rose project was very cost effective. These projects are even more so. And I think if you take any one plant or any one project out of the mix, we could pull out a whole bunch that would be even more costly. And so when you start to kind of just pick one piece out and then use the mix of all the others, you can get that price differential. But the mix of fuel sources that we have and power plants we have to serve our customers is a variety of nuclear and coal, combustion turbines that on a per unit of energy produced, that per unit of energy could be very high because you only use them a few hours a year. You build a power plant because you need it to be there and operational and able to turn on when you have that system peak. But if you take any one power plant out of that mix and look at the cost, you might get that differential. It's important that you have all of them in there. They all kind of serve a part of a purpose that's needed to provide reliable service to our customers today and, you know, August 31st or something when we might have a system peak. So it really, I think if you looked at a case just on that basis, we wouldn't be making good decisions on behalf of our customers.
Well, there might be bigger things in the picture, but clearly, if not having that in the mix saves customers money, it's more expensive than average, right?
You know, and I would have to say I'm not sure if I got that in essence that correct in terms of the Prairie Rose and with it out in the energy mix. That's also a today look. It's something that can change in 5 years. And it's something we expect will change as the price of natural gas, we expect, based upon all the independent forecast, will grow. So today, perhaps the Prairie Rose is that much more costly over the price of over the lifetime of the project. I mean, we believed it would save our customers money. So it's not, I mean, again, if you look at it today and you look at one piece, you get one outcome, but it needs to be looked at as part of a whole and over a 20-year period, I think.
When you were talking with Commissioner Kalk about the Minnesota renewable mandate, and North Dakota has its renewable objective of 10%. You're familiar with that?
Yes.
So when our objective says that 10% of all electricity sold at retail within the state by the year 2015 be obtained from renewable energy and recycled energy sources, it doesn't say at least 10% or more than 10%. It says 10%. So as we look at elevating your mix from well above 10% to even farther above 10%, tell me how that works, knowing that objective is in the Century Code.
Okay. Well, I think the objective is an objective that sets a clear, you know, policy for the state. It's very hard to hit precisely 10%, first of all, I'll say, when we add resources in chunks of, we don't add it in little pieces. It's not efficient to do that. So we could never really hit 10% and keep it at 10% all the time. But I think we also, would look at, even if it's a renewable resource, does it save customers money? So would you not want, would we not bring forward a resource because it is renewable in order to not go above 10% and forego the opportunity to save our customers money? I think the first thing would be save your customers money wherever you can, you know, meet those objectives as best you can, do it in a way that, you know, serves all of those needs. And I think that's what we try to do. We're working with the, looking at the state of North Dakota's renewable energy objective. We're part of a larger system that has to serve all of the states. So we try to meet all of those objectives, comply with all of our state's requirements and objectives in a way that also serves our customers with reliable and low-cost energy. And I think that, that's what guides us, and I think that we have largely succeeded in that, even if today we're slightly above, not exactly at 10%, I think perhaps above that for North Dakota. I think we've been able to do it in a way that serves our customers well on today's cost and for risk mitigation in the future.
Can that argument, if the numbers over years, maybe the turbines don't last as long as hoped or something, if that argument switches that, in fact, the wind energy is not as good of a deal as you're projecting, can that argument be made in Minnesota that, we're not meeting that objective, but we're doing it because it saves money? Or is that a standard that has to be met?
In Minnesota, the renewable energy standard in Minnesota? I'm not sure if I understand the question.
You made the argument that, well, we're already above this and we're moving farther above it, but it's because it's to save money. So we're not going to worry about the objective. Would you make that argument the opposite way in Minnesota if, in fact, it turns out that the wind energy is more expensive and say, well, we're not meeting your standard, but it's to save money, so it should be okay?
Oh, okay. If I understand what you're saying, if we felt that to comply with the renewable energy standard in Minnesota would bring unreasonable cost to our customers, then we would come back and say, we think that we need to revisit this because the cost impact to customers is not reasonable. And there is a provision in the law that says you can look at cost as well as transmission availability. And if those are sort of off-ramps to meeting that Minnesota renewable energy standard.
Okay. And then lastly, I'm trying to understand Minnesota's law, and to make the math easier, for the sake of the question, let's assume North Dakota and Minnesota are the same size, okay? So if Minnesota's requiring 30%, does that mean that all of your energy that you sell in North Dakota and Minnesota, 30% needs to come from renewable? Or would they look at it as, well, Minnesota requires 30, North Dakota requires 10, so thus if you get 20% renewable, you have met the average. What does their standard mean?
Commissioner, their standard means that of the energy that we sell to our customers in Minnesota, 30% of it has to come from a renewable energy source that meets Minnesota's definition of renewable. Given that we have our system is one integrated system, whatever we build serves all of our customers, so I think it is fair that, if it goes into the pool, it comes out in the same proportion to serve all of our customers, so I think it would be comparable. I think it would be, if we're serving 30% of our energy needs are coming from renewable energy sources by the year 2020, that is our whole system. So I think proportionally it's the same thing that comes to the state of North Dakota.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Carton, thank you as well. I'll do my best to ask questions in some sort of a sensible order, but my notes are all over the place, so no promises on that. First of all, my big concern is demand. There isn't a need for this energy. The demand is not growing. You've said here you don't need baseload. So why do you, does Xcel need to buy 600 megawatts? And at what point is there a, does the risk reward of overbuilding become too great where you just say, no, this is enough? When is it, when do you have enough energy?
Okay. You're correct. We didn't have an energy shortfall that we had to go out and fill. We went out seeking whether or not the market was such that we could secure an energy price or projects that would allow us to reduce customers' energy prices. So we don't need new energy, but by bringing this on, we can lower the price of the energy that we serve our customers. So I would say it's part of how we do business. We're always looking for ways that we can reduce the cost of the energy that we provide to our customers. It's what our customers expect us to do. I think it's what you as commissioners expect us to do. So it was driven by, are there opportunities out there that we can capture today that will lower customers' costs? And that's exactly what these projects do. With the fixed price of the power purchase agreements, with the purchase price of the owned projects, and the potential that they can provide value as we continue to own them beyond what would otherwise be the termination of a power purchase agreement. So that was why we did it. That's the value to customers. Your other question was, at what point do we think we've got, you know, it's too much wind or it's enough or something like that? Mm-hmm. I don't think that we are close to that point in terms of if it's a good price, we think we can integrate it. We think we can manage it in our system well. So I don't think that this additional wind puts us even close to what that point would be. I don't know where that point is. Mm-hmm.
So with this philosophy or this approach, you could theoretically go out and buy almost unlimited amounts of low-cost energy and never have too much?
Well, we would always have to look at that within the context of, to meet our customers' needs, we need a mix of energy sources. Mm-hmm. So you've got to figure out what type of, it's not without limit. It's got to fit within that mix of, we have base load power plants, we have diverse energy supply, we have power plants that can operate for maybe, you know, the shoulder periods of the day, we have power plants that we can call on to operate during peak. So there is a system and a methodology and a logic that has to apply to how you build your full mix of your energy resources. The wind projects that we're proposing here today fit very well into that, and they lower our customers' prices. Adding more and more, I don't know how much we add of wind and how it fits with all the rest of our pieces of our resource, but I don't know where that marker is. Mm-hmm. But I think that is part of what we look at with resource planning. I think maybe Kurt Hager could kind of talk more about how we look at this intermittent resource and how it fits within all of our other resources.
Okay. Well, and maybe he's the one, but I'll just throw this out there and he can be thinking about it. In your testimony, and somebody's company testimony talked about the no need for baseload, for additional baseload. I think even you said it this morning. So at what point do these intermittent resources like wind, solar, the renewables erode the need for baseload to the point that it's a risk, that you're eroding it too far, and now you don't have enough baseload?
You know, that is a part of what we would look at in resource planning, because we, I guess our first call or our first responsibility is reliability. Build a system that you know will provide reliable service. So you have to look at, what do you need for baseload? What do you need 24/7? What do you need that you can call on and it will turn on when you need it? How do you integrate the intermittent resources in with that? So that really is the first charge of our resource planning, is to look at that. So our resource planning, we look out over 20 years and we make decisions kind of year by year, but we're always taking that long view look to say, what do we know now? When is the need? And that helps inform the decisions that we make today. But I think that, you know, basically it all goes back to making sure that whatever mix of energy resources we put together, first of all, meets that reliability need.
Okay. Commissioner Chrisman asked about this, and I'm going to do a follow-up question to his. Regarding the cost analysis of these proposals, I'm not sure on the strategist model if it takes into – what factors are taken into account, and maybe this is Mr. Hager as well, but you have to have the baseload to back up these intermittent resources. So does the modeling on cost just purely look at this is what the fuel cost rider is going to – here's what the power purchase agreement says, cost per kilowatt hour. Or does it take into consideration at any point – the cost of having the base load, a percentage addition onto that per megawatt, the cost of having that base load available as a backup? Is that part of the modeling?
In short, it is, because the strategist modeling looks at what are all the resources needed to meet customers' needs, and you run sort of two versions. And so it has the base load in it. It has natural gas plants that operate less often. It has the peakers. So you run two or several versions, as a matter of fact, in where you're always comparing, here's what it would cost to run that whole system over this period with one set of resources. Now let's put in the wind. How do those two cases compare? And that's where you look at the difference in cost and you get the cost savings. So I would direct you to, you're correct, Kurt Hager could talk you through that at a deeper level of detail.
Okay, so but just so I capture this in my brain while you've just said it. Mm-hmm. So it's a, the models take the system as a whole. So then if you're looking at what it costs with the wind on, there is a cost factor in there for the baseload backup. That's included in the
all of those costs are included, Commissioner, and part of our part of the modeling input includes a cost for something called wind integration. And one of the reasons I've said we believe our analysis is very conservative is we used a very conservatively high cost for wind integration, you know, looking out over 20 years, compared to even what we spend today on that in the MISO market. So I would say that we make the effort to try to capture all of those costs in that modeling.
Okay. So then what we don't know for sure, and Mr. Hager can address this, is whether the costs for the base load are calculated at a higher rate, recognizing that they're being used less often, and so they're probably going to be more expensive on a per unit basis.
I don't know that the probably is a correct conclusion, and Kurt could answer that. Yes.
All right. If NSP didn't purchase these wind projects in Minnesota, would they exist? What would happen to these projects if you didn't have these power purchase agreements?
I don't know. I don't know if they would be built and as, let's say, what we call merchant, where you just kind of build it and they think they can sell the power. I don't know. I think that in order for an investment for a 200-megawatt wind farm to go forward, I think they – I can't speak to the developers, I guess, whether this was something they would go forward with or not.
Okay. Let's see. Looking at page worksheet 17, I think it was in Wishart's testimony. I can find that now.
I wonder if this is Exhibit 3. July 26, 2013. Yep. Okay.
Page 17 there. This is the strategist simulations of the displaced energy. So I'm looking at this long-term out to 2035. So it looks to me with this model, my question, this model is telling me something that it isn't intended to, but I'm just looking at that, and I see the mix there is almost all natural gas and wind, very little coal being displaced by the wind. Is this what we're looking at long-term, do you think, gas and wind as our energy mix long-term?
Commissioner, I think if what I've heard from many utilities is that in their future resource needs, they're looking at largely gas and other renewable energy sources. I think a lot of that is due to the uncertainty around regulation on coal. I think in the MISO market, as MISO has been trying to look out over and do its long-term planning, it has made remarks and said we're hearing from different companies that at certain dates they're planning to retire coal units. We're wondering where the rest of the energy is going to come from. We need certainty. So based upon what I read in the industry, this is what I'm hearing, is that as coal plants get older and older and they face the end of their life or significant investment, that there is the a trend towards less coal and more natural gas. And I think this is also something that Kurt Hager could speak to directly.
From a policy standpoint, do you think the electric companies, including NSP, are being active enough in pointing out to policymakers the risk of that?
Well, Commissioner,
or just going along with it, like, okay, well, we have all this shale gas now, so we can hopefully do this, but it's very unproven, and we're making long-term decisions on coal that might be irreversible.
Well, Commissioner, I think that this is the public policy debate of the country that we're all engaged in, and as the utility, you know, we have pointed out the value of having a diverse energy supply, particularly with our Sherburne County plant. It's our largest power plant, coal-fueled. Our King plant, also a very large coal-fueled power plant. But we are not, it is a public policy issue that everybody's involved in on a state level and on a federal level. So I think that we have tried to make the point of the value of diverse energy supply, how coal plays a role in that. We've also tried to engage on a federal level on public policy debates about, well, it is the national, it's the global discussion, I would say.
Okay. Minnesota Chamber filed some pretty interesting testimony in your Minnesota deliberations. Talking about some of the protections that aren't in place with these contracts and perhaps should be. They also talked about concerns with the modeling and not enough focus being given to the risks, and I would echo those and have concerns about the strategist modeling too. But that said, they offer some interesting comments about protections for customers in the instance that things don't go as planned. Are you open, is your company open to those similar types of protections being included in North Dakota?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Let me just quick buzz through my other little packet here. Make sure I'm not missing any other questions I want to ask you. Okay. I think the rest of my questions are for your next witness. Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk, did you have any follow-up?
You must know me, Your Honor, too well, huh? Yes, Your Honor, just one or two.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura, again, for your testimony. Just I know that Dave Sederquist and Mark Nesbitt are your North Dakota, I call them touch points, lobbyists for legislative things, do a great job. Who's your D.C. lobbyist for the XL?
John O'Donnell is the head lobbyist in D.C.
Does John have any sense about whether the production tax credit will be extended this next year, and when does that usually come about?
I don't know when it expires. I haven't talked with him recently. I don't know what his feeling is. So it would be in 2014. At the end, you know, so much, it's this stuff. I would say I wouldn't make a bet on it right now. Yeah. I don't know what his sense is.
Okay. The
who cares?
Where I'm going with it is just the question on the – if the production tax credits – let me phrase this – if this doesn't all come together by the end of this year and the production tax credits would be renewed, Is there caveats that this whole matrix of things could slide into the next year? Or is it, I mean, is the December 31 deadline solely based on production tax credits? And then if it is, if it's extended for next year, then there isn't that same time frame of concern. I mean, would you be willing to move this thing to the next year if the tax credits are extended? Or is this kind of like this deal has to come together at the end of the end of the year?
Well, Commissioner, I think that we have contracts with each of these four, and so there's another party in each of these, and they have their sort of business issues and priorities and needs. So I
are those contracts, is there a provision that would allow them to be extended into the next year if the it was what are these done at December 31st, or what's the end date of these contracts?
I'm not familiar with all the provisions. That I think, as most contracts, these have some latitude, some time frame that either party can choose to go forward or not, depending upon if certain things have come through that each party needs. So I don't know that there is a drop dead at December 31st.
Is that something we could find out between now and the end of the next witness, just what these contracts, if it's not trade secret, if you will?
We have the contracts available, so I think
Commissioner Calk, I can speak to that. The currently effective production tax credits are not sort of what have historically been, which means you have to be in service and producing power by
they're just concrete
by the end of the
foundations
year.
Or something.
Right now, currently, they have to have begun substantial construction, whatever that may mean. The IRS hasn't been very clear. People are considering that to be about an expenditure of 5% of project costs by the end of 13. There's been additional guidance issued by the IRS that essentially says if you're in service by the end of 2015, that that you can go ahead and you will qualify for the production tax credit. So the PTC system that exists for these projects is a little different than it has been historically. Under the contracts, the requirement – well, actually, that's trade secret, so we can't talk about it in a closed session, but I actually can't talk about it in an open session,
understood.
How the PTC issues work.
I guess what the trying to get to, if I understand what you're saying, because there's all those caveats in this one, so it's unlikely perhaps there'll be a whole new production tax credit in January because of all the caveats that are on the current production tax credit.
That's correct. Historically, it's been end of year 13 or then right. 14, and this is just very different.
Okay.
All right. That Thank came you. From Mr. Simpson. It's not testimony. This is information. And, you know, maybe if that's important to address in briefs, you might do that, Mr. Simpson.
Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you, Laura. That was really it. I was just trying to make sure I'm understanding how the production tax credit. And we've had this in other hearings about the caveat. So thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman, do you have any follow-up questions?
No, Your Honor. I think my other questions are for Mr. Hager and Ms. Cardwell.
All right. And Commissioner Fedorchuk, any follow-up?
Nope.
All right. I'll go back to Ms. Valley. Ms. Valley, do you have any redirect?
Thank you, Your Honor. No.
All right. Mr. Norell, any further questions for this witness?
Yes, Your Honor, just a few. Ms. McCartan, when you were talking with Mr. Armstrong, you had mentioned that the company was very conservative in its modeling of wind. How do you know that it's conservative in its modeling of wind?
I'm saying that based upon the people who actually did the modeling, so I'm not speaking from direct experience, but I think they made choices in several aspects to represent energy production or cost associated with running the wind that we believe are conservative. And I think Kurt could go into specific detail on what some of those things that we think are conservatisms are.
Okay. Do you happen to know if any of the wind farms that you guys currently have produced more wind than was modeled?
I don't know.
I guess the... another question had come up, I think, in conversation with Commissioner Calk. There was talk about the solar mandate. And I was just wondering, we were just wondering for some clarification, is that 1.5% solar, is that in addition to the 30% renewable, or is that part of the 30% in Minnesota?
You know, I'm not certain. You know, the legislation wasn't real clear on that. So I'm not certain.
And there's another thing, too, that it's kind of been danced around, and I just want to see if we can maybe get on the record, is you talked with both Commissioners Fedorchak and Kalk about this is an opportunity to lower rates to ratepayers, and that's based on the PTC, is that correct? If the PTC wasn't here, this wouldn't be cost-effective, is that correct?
I believe that's correct, because the PTC is like a third to a half of, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then, I guess, what would you say to the XL ratepayer somewhere out there who's saying, well, I'm paying for this twice. I'm paying the rates, and I'm paying the taxes, because it's a tax credit. How would you address that?
Well, I would say that I don't know how much an I mean, the PTC is something that's paid for by the whole of the country, and our customers get low-priced wind by securing these projects. So I would say that the PTC exists as federal policy. We're acting as an opportunity to lower prices for our customers.
No further questions, Jenna.
All right, thank you. From any of the advocacy staff? All right.
No questions.
All right, thank you. Mr. Armstrong, do you have any follow-up?
Just a few, I hope. I'll just stick with the PTC as we begin, just so my understanding is correct. As I hear it, we wouldn't be here today without the PTC being extended.
I think that's correct.
And if there is substantial construction within 2013, is it your understanding that that PTC will apply to the life of these projects, or is there a risk that could get taken away?
I don't know exactly how the PTC applies, but I think once it's there, however it's defined today, it's there and it won't be taken away in year two or year three. Now, how through the life of the project, how long does the PTC apply? I'm not exactly certain if it's 10 years or the full lifetime of the project.
And maybe that'd be a question for Mr. Hager, but do you know if that's worked into the models that have been used?
Yes, it would definitely have been reflected in the modeling.
The rest of my questions are probably just more follow-ups and maybe cleaning up some of the record. I asked you some questions earlier about the combustion turbines, and we had a discussion at the beginning about taking official notice of other records. And are you familiar that those, when I'm talking about the combustion turbines, that's what's been requested for an ADP and a PCNN in the Hankinson cases, what we call them, correct?
Yes, that's what I understood was the context of your questions, yes.
A couple questions, maybe if you can clarify for me on the Minnesota renewable issue. My understanding is I think what you said is you have to have 30% by 2020 and 25% of that has to be wind.
Right.
What happens if you don't meet that requirement?
To my understanding, there's not like a sanction or penalty outlined in law. If we don't meet it, we would have to show why we didn't meet it. And if the reason is, and back when it was first passed, there was concern that would there be transmission, because the transmission system hadn't been built up to the capacity it would need to be to transfer energy, wind energy, from long distances to load centers. So I think we would have to come in and say we didn't meet it, or we propose not to meet it for these reasons, whether it be cost or... I don't think transmission today is an issue, but perhaps it could be.
And then, okay, so if you do meet it, how long do you have to maintain it?
I don't recall the exact wording of the legislation, whether it's just you maintain it at 30% thereout, and as your customer, it's phrased as 30% of your customer's energy use. So if your customer energy use is growing, then and you maintained at 30%, then you would presumably have to keep investing to continue to meet that.
This may be more of a legal question, but I don't know the answer. So if there's really not a penalty or anything that you're aware of if you don't meet it, it's kind of a justification, or do you know who enforces that requirement?
Well, I think, you know, we would start with the Public Utility Commission, but it is a state law. But the Public Utility Commission has, you know, is authorized and fulfills the role of overseeing what we do and how we get to exactly how we get to meeting those state laws. So I really don't know the answer to how that would work, whether, you know, what the role of the Public Utility Commission would be in Minnesota, the role of the legislature.
So there may be some justification for not meeting it, but it's the requirement that you do meet it.
We, you know, we work, this is the world we're in. We do have to, if we got to that point, I think we would, if we saw it coming, we would certainly try to reach out to all the stakeholders and policymakers to make sure we were kind of approaching this without any surprises, and we could all work together on what did it mean, what caused it, how do we deal with it.
And I just, the 30% is, as I understood your testimony, was for your sales in Minnesota, you have to have 30% from renewable sources.
Right.
And I was a little unclear with, I think it was Commissioner Christman's questions of how that relates to North Dakota. I mean, can you take it, let's just, using really round numbers here, say you have, 100 units in Minnesota, so 30 of those mm-hmm. have to come from renewables, correct?
Yeah.
And let's say you sell 100 units in North Dakota. You don't have to, can you, say, designate, look, we're saying the renewables we produce are all going to Minnesota to meet our 30%, and we're not counting what we sell to North Dakota as renewables? Do you understand where I'm getting at?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. When we figure out how many units of renewable we need to meet the Minnesota standard, we base it on the energy use of just the Minnesota customers. So when we do the calculation that results in here's how much renewable energy you have to add to your system, you start with the energy use of the Minnesota customers to meet that Minnesota standard. Once you build it and put it into your system, it goes to everybody.
Yeah, I understand the practical part.
Okay.
Once it's in the line,
yeah.
The person who's putting the lights on doesn't care if it comes from coal or from wind.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how you, and maybe you can answer me, how you comply with Minnesota. For instance, let's just say from your whole North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, you've got 3,000 units that are used in a year, and 1,000 of them are in Minnesota. And overall, you produce 300 units of renewable. Can you just use those and say, look, we've met the Minnesota, or do you have to somehow disperse it out over the territory you serve? If that made any sense to you.
I just don't think I can answer your question. I mean, I'm not sure of your question. So other than kind of talking about, we calculate just based on Minnesota usage, how much we have to build to meet the Minnesota standard. Whether that's where that's exactly located in that whole pool and the footprint that we serve, I mean, I'm not sure if I, I'm sorry, I'm just not following your question or what you're trying to.
That's fine. The $180 million that's supposed to be saved on the 706, 707, 708, is that $180 million North Dakota ratepayers, or is that all your ratepayers?
That's everybody.
And the same with them would be the $45 million for the Border Winds project that would be for all of your ratepayers.
Right.
Do you have any, is there anywhere where it talks about what it would be for just North Dakota?
Well, the reason it's represented as a whole system is because our system operates as a whole. It's an integrated system. We've talked about that before. And the strategist model reflects the operation of the system as a whole. So when we look at what those savings are, generally they're spread proportionally across all of the customers that we serve. So if we use the 4% number, I think someone suggested that North Dakota was 4%, then they should get 4% of those savings. I mean, they get the same proportional savings as any of the other customers served by our integrated system.
That's all the questions I had.
And just to make sure it's clear in the record, Mr. Armstrong, I think if you look in Exhibit 1, it's that $180 million was corrected to actually be $176 million. Is that correct, Ms. McCartan?
That's correct, Judge.
All right, thank you. All right, I'll just open it up. Any further questions for Ms. McCartan? Ms. Valley? Oh, Commissioner Christman, did you have a question?
I do, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
That line of questioning reminded me of one more. So using round numbers, if there's $176 million of savings, 4% is North Dakota, so maybe $7 million of savings for North Dakota. I'm not quite convinced yet that those savings are there, but for this question, we'll assume that they're there. And since the letter that Chairman Kalk sent out and we're using information from these various cases in each other, is the basis of the rate case calculating that $7 million of savings in, or if we deny this, would you be then suggesting you need another $7 million increase? Or if we approve this, can we subtract $7 million? Or where does this, how does that play together?
Okay, Commissioner, the rate case we had before you was costs that we have to incur today to serve customers' needs. So those it's not like if we have these costs, we don't need those. If we are, for example, on the projects that are power purchase agreements, typically those flow through the fuel clause. Those just go directly as savings to customers. So it's not part of a rate case. The projects that we would own, that we would have as part of a rate case, that would be a future. That would be. It's not part of the current rate case. But I think again, what we'd look at is say we think it's. We would make the case for it. Let's say in a rate case for those own projects, that by putting this in the rate case, it's part of helping to lower our customers' cost, not in base rates, but in the fuel clause, because we wouldn't be flowing through the fuel clause higher priced energy purchases, because the wind, operating those wind projects, displaces the production of that same amount of energy from higher priced sources. So that means that our customers would benefit because the fuel clause portion would be less.
So the rates that you have requested do not reflect any of these potential savings?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Valley?
Thank you. Several questions have been raised today about the Minnesota process and reviewing the compliance with our renewable energy standards. I thought we could follow up with some questions for Ms. McCartan.
If I can answer it. Just
Ms. McCartan, are you aware that the company files resource plans with the Minnesota Commission periodically?
Yes.
And as part of those resource plans, does the company report on its renewable energy standard compliance?
Yes.
And you had mentioned in the course of the discussion that there are these off-ramps. If the investment isn't cost-effective or if there are other technical constraints, that those investments to proceed with that RES would not be made. Is that resource plan proceeding an opportunity for the Minnesota Commission to review periodically whether the company is on track and whether there are reasons to not be on track if circumstances warrant?
Yes, the resource plan proceeding provides the perfect venue for those type of discussions.
And as the company proceeds with its resource planning, does the company look to achieving the goals and standards of the various jurisdictions that it serves in a cost-effective manner in compliance with the terms of those statutes?
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right. Did that raise any further questions? Commissioner Fedorchik?
Just one to clarify my understanding of the Minnesota requirement. It's 30% by 2020, and is it 30% of your generation capacity, or is it 30% of the actual energy produced and sold?
Commissioner, the measure is based upon how much energy our customers use, so it's more of the latter.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. Do you know what that mix is today?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. We actually have in the test, I actually have a note here.
Not of your capacity, but of the actual.
Of the energy used. In our system, I believe that this year we're going to be close to 13% of our energy coming from renewable energy sources.
Okay. And you have to be up to 30% in 7 years?
Yes. And that measure can be the 13% number I gave you is actual energy generated. When we look at meeting the renewable energy standard, we look at both the energy generated in that year and renewable credits from previous years where we generated more than was needed to meet the standard, and we can carry those over. They have a 4-year life. Mm-hmm. So you can carry them over for 4 years. So we look at how many RECs, renewable energy credits, plus actual amount of generation that year and say, how does this compare to the standard? The 13% I gave you was the actual amount of generation. I think that's a rough approximation for what we'll see in 2013.
So your Minnesota customers are actually getting 13% of their energy they're using from wind?
Yeah, I think that's all
or
of our
whatever.
Yeah, our whole the integrated system. Yeah, okay. About that 13%.
And then is it a stair step? So there's like targets to meet along the way.
I believe that there are targets, and they're not every year. I think there's an immediate, like every couple of years, there's a milestone target between, you know, getting out to the year 2020.
Okay, that's all. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any further questions? All right, it appears that that's all the questions,
thank
Ms.
you.
McCartan. Thank you. All right, Ms. Valley, just to get a sense of time here, it's almost 11 o'clock. Does the commission want to recess about noon, slightly before? What do you want to do for a lunch break?
Whatever Carrie would want to do, I guess. If they want to finish this witness and take a break, that's fine. If you want to break at noon, I'm indifferent, I guess.
I expect this witness won't be done in an hour.
Yeah.
If it's or okay. Even an hour and a half. But... it's just my guess.
So should we...
Toward noon and see once we're ready.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, Ms. Valley, please call your next witness.
Thank you. The company calls our Director of Resource Planning, Kurt Hager.
Mr. Hager, you were present and heard me instruct as to penalties for perjury, were you not? Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth under the pains and penalties of perjury? If so, answer, I do.
I do.
Thank you. Ms. Valley, go ahead.
Thank you. We'll present Mr. Hager available for cross-examination.
All right. And I believe there's rebuttal and direct testimony already in evidence. All right. Then at this time, Mr. Norell. I'll open it for questioning for the advocacy.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Mr. Hager.
Good morning.
You're number two on the lineup, but you're batting cleanup. I'd like to start off with one of the questions that was asked to Ms. McCartan, and it was about the RES Americas company, which is building the Pleasant Valley and Border Winds project. It's stated that the company is very experienced with an excellent track record of siting and developing projects. Can you speak to the background, the experience, how many projects RES Americas has done?
To my knowledge, RES America or RES America is a worldwide wind developer. They have, I think, somewhere close to 8,000 megawatts of wind that they've developed. If I remember correctly, a number of projects are over 50 projects. So we've experienced dealing with them in our Colorado jurisdiction, Minnesota jurisdiction, multiple jurisdictions.
I want to kind of look at modeling here. And one of the questions I was wondering is, what kind of tools did the company use to determine that these projects were cost-effective?
You know, Strategist is our primary resource planning tool. The nice thing about Strategist is it allows us to combine fixed costs, capacity costs, with energy costs, and also any kind of emissions. And so it allows, it's basically a big adding machine. It allows it to simulate dispatch, but it also allows you to optimize because it's a linear program. So it allows you to optimize different scenarios and different options. And so it's the primary tool because it's able to pick up fixed costs, dispatch costs, fuel costs, all of those costs, and pretty much come up with good summaries so you can see exactly what's going on with different scenarios. To have that flexibility, it has to take a couple shortcuts. So it doesn't plan out and dispatch every hour. So what then we do is we use other tools to make sure that Strategist is giving a good approximation of the cost. We ourselves use ProSim, which is a much more detailed dispatch model. And that allows us to check Strategist to see, is it actually picking up those hourly generation dispatch? So we inside our company also have the ProSim model that we can check, and we do check.
And that's ProSym.
ProSym, okay. P-R-O-S-Y-M. In addition to that, and again, we understand the shortcomings of Strategist. And so many times it will use ProSym or a ProSym-like model to do the wind integration studies and things like that, that we want to get very detailed hourly ramp information and things like that. And so what I'm talking about there is we have a model that's very sophisticated that looks at essentially every hour. Strategist doesn't look at every hour. It looks at average week every year. But ProSym actually goes in and looks at every hour. There's other dispatch models, Cougar and a couple others that are in the industry that, again, look at that fine dispatch detail. And so when we want to look at what are the wind integration costs, some of the coal cycling costs, those type of things, we actually go to the more refined model, ProSym or Cougar or something like that, to actually get those costs out of those models. And we add them to Strategist because we know Strategist isn't going to pick up those issues exactly. The third model we use is ProMod. So, and we use it as a data set provided by MISO. Because the important part about ProMod is it starts to pick up the issues or the costs associated with how MISO operates the system and the restrictions on the transmission system. So not only do we look at it kind of in kind of an isolation with Strategist, but we actually go above and beyond that and use the ProMod runs from MISO. And so they give us actual data sets for like 2018, 2023, 2027. And we actually can go in and look at those to say, okay, what's happening on the transmission system and their energy mix? Because one of the important things that's starting to come out is there's what they call congestion and line losses between where the generator puts in the energy and the market that uses the energy. And along those transmission paths are different prices. And so to make sure that we capture all of those costs, we actually look at that congestion or cost between the generator input and the market. And that's what ProMod's very good at. It, you know, allows us to reach out and look at what does that look like in the future, because that's a cost that we really believe our customers are going to bear. And so we did look at all of those three different runs or different model types to come up with the cost estimates.
You had mentioned the downfalls or maybe the deficiencies of Strategist. What would those be? You said the company's very aware of those. What would some of those be?
Again, it's not a refined dispatch tool. It doesn't look at every hour of generation. It looks like at an average week per month. And then again, we compare that to see is it approximating the more refined dispatch tools. And we believe that's fairly well aligned. There's always a little bit of difference. If you look at any given hour, there's going to be some difference. But over a year, those differences pretty much average out and come up with the same response on cost. Again, we know that Strategist isn't going to pick up ramp rates and things like that. So we go and look at other models to do our wind integration, which is where those costs come in.
What's the difference between now ProSym is an hourly dispatch model, is that correct?
Correct.
And then how would that compare to ProMod? That is the
ProMod is also an hourly dispatch.
Okay.
ProMod is different from the standpoint it adds transmission to the mix, not just a dispatch of the system. So we would run ProSym on our system. ProMod runs it on the MISO footprint.
In the application, it mentioned that the company had used MISO's congestion line loss estimates from the 2012 ProMod model. But in your testimony, it kind of sounded like the company did its own ProMod analysis. Can you tell, did the company do its own ProMod, or it sounds like ProMod is something that MISO does?
MISO does it, but we also run ProMod.
Okay. So which numbers did you use for the modeling in this one, for congestion and line loss, did you use MISO's 2012?
It is MISO's model. We take it, we rerun it, make sure we verify it, and then that's the number. So it's essentially the same model.
Okay.
We get the data set from MISO.
Okay. Do you compare Is there any way to true up those numbers? Do you go back and look at your projected models to what they actually were? Do you do that at all for planning purposes?
Or? In the form of a backcast?
Yeah, yep.
The backcast is very difficult to do. The issue with trying to develop a backcast is you're trying to go back in time and create a scenario that didn't happen.
Okay.
So in other words, if I were to go back to 2008, our natural gas price forecast at that time, gas was trading at $9, $12. The forecast was that it would trend higher. Then it's like kind of going back and saying, okay, how did you estimate natural gas prices? Well, there was something that was called the development of the shales in the United States that completely changed what that looked like. So trying to go back and recreate a scenario that didn't happen is very difficult. Now, what we can do and have done is gone in and said, okay, what if we put those major drivers with actual, like gas prices, actual load, and try to come back and say, okay, how well did Strategist calculate the impact? And Strategist lines up very well when we look at it from that perspective. But you have to align the inputs first, because certainly one of the reasons you use Strategist is to test different inputs. And so if I were to put in a gas price forecast at $4 and one at $6, it's going to give me a different response. It's supposed to give me a different response. Therefore, for me to go back and test it, I have to align those inputs. And once I align those inputs, then Strategist does a very good job of estimating the impacts. In fact, I just completed a study of that in Colorado.
How often does MISO prepare their ProMod studies?
They have a planning process. I'm trying to keep all the jurisdictions straight. I believe the MISO planning process that we get is every other year, but I'd have to check. I just don't remember it's every year, every other year, but I think it's every other year.
Would the 2012 ProMod numbers from MISO that you guys used, would that be the most recent, or would there be one for 2013?
I think they're in the midst of developing the 14 or getting going on that, so I think that's the next one that comes out, if I remember correctly, but I'd have to check.
The wind contracts at question here, they go for 20 years, and the company-owned projects are estimated to last about 25 years. Is that correct?
Correct.
How many years did the company use when they were modeling these projects? Do you know?
40, I believe.
40. Why 40? What's the significance of that number?
You definitely want to go long enough to make sure that you include all of the costs over the long term. We could have terminated this at 25, but our typical planning model goes to 40 because many times CT combustion turbine assets, combined cycle assets have 40-year lives. So you want to include the full life cycle cost of a unit. So typically we go out that far.
And I actually just I noticed here I'd highlighted actually this is from Mr. Wishart's testimony. This is 706, 707, 708. Page 14, line 1, he mentions the 40 years. And it says this that the company had simulated the operation of the NSP system over the next 40 years with and without the addition of the 600 megawatts of wind generation proposed in this petition. Do you happen to know, during that simulation, was there any additional conventional generation that was added into the system?
Yes, typically, again, how resource planning is typically done, it's you establish a base model, and then you look at different factors, so you're examining different questions, and you're running what-if cases or scenarios against that base model. So one of the questions that was raised today is, when we look at adding wind, do we account for all of the cost of our base load plants? Well, since all of the fixed costs are in the model and stay in there, and when we bring in wind, we only look at variable costs, you know, things that we won't incur if it doesn't run, then in effect, we're looking at that delta analysis. And by doing so, we include all of the costs of those fixed units that have to be recovered. And yes, when you spread them over fewer units, on a unit cost, they go up. That's all calculated in the model. It's all there. And so we run these delta runs. So we can put in wind and see what happens and compare it to a model that didn't have wind. And so when you look at building out that base model, it certainly has units that are put in, thermal units, to make sure that the capacity there and to make sure that the energy is served. And then you pull specific issues or specific resources out or put specific resources in to test the cost effectiveness of those different options.
Kind of going at modeling here, too, on the questions I had asked Ms. McCartan, she thought that maybe I could address it to you. Do you guys have anywhere any studies that show any of the wind farms in the system outperforming what they are modeled to perform?
You know, I didn't look at that specifically. I know from other jurisdictions, I didn't look at specifically Minnesota, but in the Colorado case recently, our projected generation significantly outpaced what was originally put in the contracts. And the reason I know this, in Colorado we have what's called a no-res run, which means we look at exactly the same kind of concept we're looking here, but on a kind of on-you-as-you-go basis. And I know that the energy that was predicted in the original runs is being outstripped. It's more today than it was in those original runs. And so I know from the other jurisdictions that that is typically the case with large commercial projects. I cannot say for some of these small projects if that's that Minnesota has quite a few small little ones, if that's the case.
On your rebuttal testimony, page 8, figure 1, there was a... This figure shows the percent of hours with negative prices, and it shows a low percent of hours. Do you happen to know the actual number of how many hours there are with negative prices?
I believe Ms. Carden had some information in her testimony about some actual number of hours. Again, what I struggled with that is cumulative number of hours is not, in my mind, very valuable because it's the question of how many hours at a given point. Because when you're looking at 30, 40 or nodes, all of 8760 is the number of hours in a year, you're really trying to assess how many hours do you have negative LMPs within a year. Obviously, if I were to have that and say, well, I add 3 more nodes, then I add another 24,000 hours to it. And so having the total hours has to be in context of how many total hours of generation are available at those nodes. And that's why I suggested a percentage is a much more appropriate way to look at it than just total hours.
Do you happen to know what the current annual costs of curtailment payments are right now that the company pays to wind projects?
I actually think it's in our discovery response. I believe it was like $1 million.
Your Honor, if I may refresh the witness's memory.
Go ahead, Mr. Simpson.
Can you repeat that question, Ryan?
I'm just wondering what the current annual costs of curtailment payments are that the company makes right now.
It was provided in response data request SC-02-006. In that presentation, there are the listing for 2011-12 and a partial year for 13 for the amount of lost production due to curtailment and also the amount paid. I don't actually, I haven't summarized this up, but if I look at it quickly, that looks like 1,000,004, 1,000,056. It looks like somewhere in 12 it was maybe $2 million.
Do you know what the estimated annual curtailment costs will be on these projects?
It's calculated within the model. It's approximately 10% of the energy over the first 10 years. I don't have a specific number of what was calculated in the model. Basically, the model, when it has too much energy to serve the load, because a conservative view of this is we don't allow the model to sell into MISO. That's how the real world would work, though, is we would sell our excess energy into MISO. But for the purpose of this modeling, to make it simpler again to use strategist and also to be more conservative, we don't allow that to happen. In those model runs, we estimated that the curtailment might be as high as 10% over the first 10 years. What I didn't look at is the additional cost of that in that 10-year period, because it's a byproduct of the modeling itself. Essentially what happens is strategist is trying to serve the energy with what it has. If it has too much energy, it has a column that's dump energy, which basically means it's got to be curtailed or sold. In our assumption, we assume that it was curtailed.
Were the curtailment payments for these new projects modeled consistently over the test period, or is there peaks and valleys, or how does that look on a...
Again, since it's a model output, the model actually predicts when the curtailment will happen and what the makeup energy cost is, and that's a function of the modeling itself. So the numbers presented here would include all of those costs. Therefore, the savings that we're seeing are actually higher and reduced because of those curtailment expected costs.
How do company-owned projects fit into the curtailment process? Do you curtail your own owned projects first, or where do they fit in the process?
There's a hierarchy associated with curtailment. Some projects we have free curtailment provisions, so those would be curtailed first. Some projects don't have any PTC credit, so we would curtail those first. I think it really would get to the question of how deep the curtailment would be, and what is the most cost-effective way to curtail energy. So we have a very specific protocol to make sure that we curtail it in the most cost-effective manner.
With the addition of these resources before the commission here, when would the company expect to next need to let me rephrase that. When would you next need to add resources to meet the Minnesota renewable mandate?
The Minnesota renewable mandate, there was a lot of questions about this morning. We meet it through retiring renewable energy credits. And so when we look at retiring renewable energy credits, that's one credit per 1 megawatt hour of like wind generation or solar or clean energy. As it said, we overproduce, we're allowed to bank, we take that bank, we spread out our compliance. And so the fact is that you basically have like a bank of pieces of paper that are credits that say you can cash those in to go ahead and meet compliance. And so when we look at planning out that to making sure that we keep the inventory of credits moving forward as the standard increases over time, which it does, then we get to the point in about 2023 where our bank is no longer sufficient along with the amount of credits that are generating in that year. So that year's production plus whatever banked is no longer sufficient to meet the standard. And right now we see that crossover point about 2023.
So that's when you need to add more renewables, or somewhere in that time frame?
We could certainly add more renewables, or to the extent that we acquired RECs or something from a Minnesota project or something like that. It could be that we could extend out that bank. So, I mean, that's something that we always look at.
Do you know, would the company need to add any resources to meet the North Dakota objective? I think it was said earlier that the company is already beyond the North Dakota objective, but...
Yes, my understanding is that we are beyond and that we have surplus RECs.
When the, I guess kind of in modeling maybe, were there any externalities in the analyses of these wind projects, CO2, NOS, anything like that?
The CO2 was shown as a separate item, so we did run a case with carbon without. The numbers that we've been talking about this morning are without any carbon cost. I believe that the original run, the information was presented, did have some externality costs for NOx and some other costs of pollutants or emissions, and that was one of the corrections that was made, is to remove those to make sure that it was a clean set of costs.
It was mentioned a few times in Mr. Wishart's direct testimony that this is a hedge against carbon legislation. Could that be considered a qualitative externality when looking at carbon?
Certainly.
And what's the value of that to the company or to the ratepayers?
Well, you know, carbon's the big elephant in the room, right? I mean, everybody's got their idea of what carbon should be or shouldn't be, or should there be any carbon. And frankly, I deal in jurisdictions from North Dakota, South Dakota to Texas that have different views compared to a lot of other jurisdictions. And so certainly there is a wide range of expectations. What I think what most people will agree that they believe there is some carbon risk. And is it really to the point of being able to quantify that? And that's very difficult. Typically, we do our resource planning so we show no carbon and then some level of carbon, depending upon what jurisdiction we're in and whatever we're dealing with, so people can see the impact of what decisions are changed with or without that risk. And that tends to be more of the qualitative way of looking at it, to say, okay, if I were to pick a set of resources without carbon – and I would pick a set of resources, different resources, with carbon proxy cost, I can start judging then qualitatively which side do I want to be on. We typically run both cases so that people have a clear distinction of, is there any kind of change or difference? It's just not cost. It allows you to kind of look at, will it actually change your decision making?
What's the company's position on any pending carbon legislation regulation? Do you think that's coming down the pike?
You know, I believe that there is some carbon risk out there. I don't know when it's going to happen. We, again, look to typical forecasting agencies. PIRA, which is, I think it used to stand for Petroleum Institute, but I don't research associates, but they just call themselves PIRA now. It's one of the nation-leading forecasting agencies. Cambridge Energy Research Associates, CERA, Wood Mackenzie. We look to those type of people to actually come up with estimates of all of the discussions that they monitor in Washington, what their expectations are. And really, that's one of the foundations we use to say that should be then the carbon scenario we run. Minnesota has a specific carbon value that they want us to look at. Many of our other jurisdictions, we use that blend again to kind of look at what is that carbon risk. I think Xcel Energy believes there is some carbon risk. We have a hard time quantifying it ourselves.
The company, going to wind integration costs here, I apologize, I'm kind of jumping around, but the company had identified two different sets of costs for wind integration. In your testimony, you had stated that the company includes $7.6 million per year to account for integration costs, and that's the same number that was used in the original application. But in the in Ms. McCartan's rebuttal testimony, there was the schedule that was included, the letter to the Minnesota Commission, and that number was $8.5 million. Do you happen to know which number would be correct for wind integration? Would be the 7.6 or the 8.5?
I actually believe it's closer to 12.
Third number.
The 7-6, I think, was an initial run, and it stayed in the testimony based upon the 600 megawatts, not the 750 megawatts. It was also based upon, if I remember correct, there was a little nuance either in gas prices or something that changed it a little bit. And that when you look at the total amount of the 600 plus the 150, we're actually closer to probably to $12 million of overall integration cost.
That same schedule I was referencing from Ms. McCartan's testimony had indicated that the Department of Commerce in Minnesota had used a higher number. Do you know, was that $12 million closer to what?
I believe it probably was. That was the number.
In your testimony, you had stated that the $7.6 million included some $1.1 million per year of ancillary services, ancillary service costs. Would that be going up then as well?
No, that was really the actual of what we've been experiencing in MISO, that the number has been significantly less than the model had forecasted. And again, when you one of the purposes of MISO is to spread out energy and to be able to dispatch against a wider footprint. And so some of those benefits are very difficult for us to capture in these wind integrations because we tend to look more at islands. And so these costs were developed more looking at that island view and not the benefits of spreading those risks and energy across a wider footprint. And so when we look at the actual costs that we start to see in the ancillary service market in MISO, it's significantly less. Again, but that's one of our conservative points that we said we're going to stay with the island look, the more conservative look for energy, because there are some other things that, you know, we always don't know exactly what's going to happen. So we stay on the conservative side and say if these projects make it through at that level, then we think that they're definitely going to be good projects in the long term.
Do you have any estimates? You've mentioned the costs right now are low. Do you have any estimates as to how ancillary service costs will increase over time? Or,
you know, if you look at the type of resource that's being put in and installed, a lot of entities are moving away from baseload non-flexible units, and they're moving towards more CTs and CTs that have flexibility. And so when you look at the pattern of what's happening in the market, more flexibility is coming in the market by itself, and it's not having to be paid for because it's naturally occurring. And so when we look at adding CTs, in this case, combustion turbines in Minnesota and in NSP across the footprint, we're actually seeing that flexibility being provided. Okay. And so I would expect that the cost would actually stay pretty much in the range that they are today. There's not a lot of people calling for additional flexibility to be installed because it's occurring with these units naturally. To give you an idea, a large frame combustion turbine now can start and come up to load in about 10 minutes. So the ability for it to move through, start up, and bring full output in about 10 to 15 minutes is the flexibility that the systems need. And if you look at wind profiles, we do a lot of study on wind. And if you look at wind doesn't drop off like a rock. It tends to drop off over time, and therefore operators are very comfortable in being able to watch 15-minute intervals of wind and to catch up and deal with wind. Just to give you an idea, in Colorado, we have a 6,500-megawatt system that has 2,400 megawatts of wind. And so we've been very close to watch exactly how you operate. And that system is an island. You've got the Rocky Mountains west of Denver. You've got the Eastern Interconnect, Eastern Colorado. It essentially sits on an island. It has to balance within itself. And so we are probably one of the more premier companies of understanding how to operate wind and how to manage flexibility for wind than probably almost anybody in the United States, because we operate such a high percentage on that system in Colorado.
Thank you. There was mention earlier, I can't remember if it was you or Mr. McCartan, earlier had mentioned studies of the effects of cycling on coal plants, and there was also a conversation and some discovery and data requests. Can you tell us how many numbers of studies the company has done regarding the cycling of coal plants?
We've done one major study in the Colorado jurisdiction and some minor looks at the other jurisdictions. Again, we focused on the Colorado jurisdiction because those coal plants have to manage around the wind at a much higher percentage. So we did a very detailed study with Avtec. A consultant came in. We looked at the impacts of cycling, that amount of wind, on those that coal fleet. That's been filed at our commission. It's been approved. We use it in all of our research, our resource planning studies.
What were the results of that, if you don't mind my asking?
Sure. And that study showed about $1 per megawatt hour was the cost on that system for cycling those coal plants.
Has the company done any studies on the cycling of gas plants at all?
We have done some work at the cycling of gas plants. It hasn't been near the detailed study that the coal plant was, but we started looking into the same issues about starts. Gas units tend to start a lot and stop a lot already, and they don't have the boiler concept of having tubes that heat up, cool down, and then you get a leak. You have more of the maintenance issues associated with combustion turbines and combustion turbines on combined cycles, which their maintenance is actually set by the number of starts and stops and operating time. So we have some of that information already just because of being able to watch how units start and stop.
So you guys are less concerned about the effects of cycling on gas, just it's more flexible, would that be fair to say? Or
they're definitely more flexible in the form of the design of the unit, and again, that they don't have these boiler tubes that go into boiler walls that you have to worry about them, you know, basically shrinking and expanding all the time and getting leaks.
Kind of moving further along here, do you happen to know what the fixed price escalation rates are in the Odell and Courtney contracts, or would that be trade secret?
That would be trade secret. Okay. But I do know.
In the applications for both Pleasant Valley and Border Winds, the company had mentioned that it would accept a 25% fluctuation up or down in ongoing capital maintenance costs. What was magic about 25%? Why that number for the company?
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
Sure. Let me see if I can find it in the testimony real quick. I think it's like page 19 of application 706, 707, 708. I'm sorry, yes, exhibit 1. And about two-thirds or three-quarters of the way down, it says Pleasant Valley. In the second paragraph, it says, to test how variation from capital expenditures and O&M would impact the overall cost effectiveness, we conducted sensitivity tests and strategies of plus and minus 25% of projected ongoing capital investments and O&M expenses. And the question is just simply, why 25%?
You know, to be honest with you, I think we just picked a level to saying, what if we cut it by a quarter or increased it by a quarter? Again, it was just a sensitivity to say, if the costs were that far out, would they still be cost effective or not?
Okay. Simple enough. Why are these projects slated to go into service in 2015 as opposed to earlier? Will they be done anytime earlier than that?
Ultimately, they could be. I think, not getting into trade secret, but I think there's some flexibility associated with the in-service dates. but those are estimates that we have. Again, that would be driven by the developers.
I think there was, in the contract with Courtney, there was a, the company had stated at some point in testimony, I apologize, I don't have exactly where, but the project can't go into commercial operation prior to November 30th, 2014. Do you know if that's correct?
I think that's correct, that there's a no earlier than and then a no later than.
Why would that be no earlier than November 30th, 2014?
I think, again, that was just to the design of the negotiations and the bid that was brought in. We don't want the project to come in until everything else is in place, transmission-wise and everything, if it was an issue. And so I think that they typically have worked, you know, no earlier than and no later than provisions in there so that we make sure everything is ready to accept it.
The North Dakota income tax credit ends on January 1st, 2015. So there was also a question, was there any thought as to putting these into service prior to 2015 to help ensure being able to use that tax credit?
You know, on the borders, I don't know. The one that we would own, to be honest with you, I wasn't involved in specific. I know there was a lot of discussions about the tax credit, but I wasn't involved in a specific question of could we accelerate it to make sure it gets that. I would have to check on that for you.
Okay.
The Courtney project obviously would be up to Geronimo. They're the ones that are at risk. And
sure. In your rebuttal testimony, is that Exhibit 3? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's Exhibit 8.
There is Schedule 2 to that exhibit. I just have some questions on that. On page 10 of 12 of Schedule 2, there's what's referred to as Attachment A. Is there a title for this document?
I think it was just the cost recovered through the fuel clause rider.
The advocacy staff had sent a request for this information on September 4th, but we didn't receive a response until a week, actually 10 days ago, I'm sorry. Do you know why it took so long for the company to gather this data?
I do not.
On page 4 of Schedule 2, again, it states, there would be about a third down. It states that energy production data for certain small wind projects is not individually metered, but is instead metered and reported with other small projects on a combined or aggregate basis. How does the company know if an individual project isn't generating if it's not metered individually?
Well, certainly we would see a drop off in the aggregation, the aggregated meter. We would see a change that we could go back and see. But again, these are pretty small projects. So,
how small would you consider these to be? I'm just wondering size.
I mean, a number of them are like 2 megawatts apiece. You know, I don't know if it's really been an issue for us, and therefore has, you know, that we've needed to really address. I've not heard that. I'm not directly involved with that, but I haven't heard that that's been an issue.
Do you happen to know if a project isn't generating, what the company's policy would be in regards to those situations? Are there any contract specifications or penalties for non-performance in that circumstance?
I don't know exactly about the 2 megawatt tariff. I know a number of the larger contracts have provisions, minimum generation provisions. And again, I think we have to take those situations one at a time to see exactly what is the cause of the issue, and is it in our favor that they're not generating, or is it against us? And what can really be done? What is our remedy? So again, if you're getting partial generation out of a project that's in the money, and your remedy is to cancel the project, and therefore you incur higher costs to replace it, would it make sense to terminate the contract? Probably not. So again, you'd have to look at case by case.
Sure. Do you know how long a company would go if a renewable project wasn't generating? How long would it take before you guys would cut ties with that project?
Again, I think it's case by case depending upon what the circumstance is.
Sure. On page 6 of Schedule 2, item H, there was discussion towards the end of that paragraph. It says, energy was only purchased from, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, if it's Shaukatan. I apologize if I butchered that, but from September 2003 until September 2005. But the PPA was terminated in 2013 due to performance issues. Why the 8-year gap, well, it's 7.5-year gap between the actual purchase of power and the termination of that contract?
I don't have the specifics of that circumstance. I apologize.
Going back one page to page 5, item B, this is kind of discussing Fenton 1 and 2 and the FERC form. And it states that there are some actuals on the FERC form 1 and there are some estimations on the FERC form 1. Do you know why some actuals need to be reported and some estimates are okay to be reported?
Due to the fact of the timing when the report is developed, my understanding is that December is a forecast of what they expect. And that's what produces FERC Form 1. I also know just from general business that many times there are restatements of bills, you know, when there's an issue or a discrepancy, and they go back and clear up issues and discrepancies, and that makes minor changes from what actually ultimately flows through versus what may have been reported in a FERC Form 1 type filing. But I know specifically that December is typically a forecast month because they don't have all of the billing data by the time they develop the FERC 1 Form 1 data.
Do you know when they developed the FERC 1 form?
No. I was, again, in my research of this, they basically just said that's the process that we use. And
do you happen to know how long it takes the company, kind of along these same lines, to receive the wind production invoice, review them, and then process them for payment?
I'm not in that area. I mean, typically from my days of, I used to buy all the natural gas for the company, typically we would get a bill 20 to 25 days after the production month ended, and then we had a period of time of 30 days or whatever to pay the bill. And then again, to the extent that there are restatements in metering data, which happens all the time, that would be figured out. So I'm guessing potentially a lag of 60 days, potentially.
I was going to say there was a data request where it alluded about 60 days, and I was just going to ask, do you think that that's reasonable? Is that long, in your opinion?
Again, I can only draw upon my experience of doing all of the gas purchasing for the company, that was industry standard.
Are you familiar with the Prairie Rose Project, wind project?
Reasonably.
Okay. Do you know how much energy has been replaced with the implementation of Prairie Rose?
I did not look at the specific production out of Prairie Rose.
Okay. It was estimated, as far as we have on file in discovery request, to replace 726 gigawatt hours. Do you know, would that be anywhere close?
Again, I didn't look at actual production since the farm went into service.
Do you know, does the company have any actual updates or status of that?
I would think, yeah, I think we would have. on, like on all of our PPAs, we would have what it was since when in service.
Would the company be willing to provide that to us?
Is it? Most certainly.
Do you want that as a late filed exhibit, Mr. Norrell?
Yes. Yes, please. And that would be... And would it be possible to actually compare that back to the modeling, what was modeled for Prairie Rose?
We certainly can. The only concern I am is Prairie Rose is a new project. So when it came in service, I don't know how the ramp-up of it was. So I don't know, you know, do we look at – I'd have to look at when the expected start full production date was versus partial, to the extent that they went partial and then they had brought it up to full or whatever. So we might have to – in looking at that information, exclude months of partial startup. It's never good to look at any project, you know, to see if it's matching full output within the first 6 months of a project, because you're always going through some sort of shakeout startup phase.
Sure.
And since that is so relatively new, I'm not sure we would have to do much more investigation than just look at the numbers, because I don't think that would be really truly meaningful.
Okay. Ms. Valley, am I correct in that the company produced 8 exhibits?
Yes, Your Honor.
So this would be Exhibit 9. And what is this going to be titled?
This would be energy replacements due to the implementation of Prairie Rose. Or,
hold on. Can you clarify? I understood your request to be just its production.
Right.
The amount of energy Prairie Rose has produced.
Yes. The production of energy from Prairie Rose.
Production of energy from Prairie Rose. All right. That will be late filed Exhibit 9.
And I believe that concludes my questions.
All right. It's now 11:45. Mr. Armstrong, will you be able to complete questioning in 15 minutes? Whatever you tell me, I'm going to multiply it by 3.
My guess would be 25, 20 to 25, so I would suggest probably a good time for a lunch break, and I can consult with staff also.
All right. We will take a lunch break until 1 o'clock.